Hey everyone, welcome back to the Scott Stokely podcast. And you guys know by now, I love talking to people with stories, interesting stories, stories that just turn out well and easy are not good stories. We don't like sharing those. Those are boring. I'm happy for the people that have those lives. But in the real world, that's not something you sit around and talk about at the campfire. I have George Johnson with me. George wrote a book called Double Crossed that profiles his life from, do I sound like too suburby if I say the street?
No, you don't sound too suburban. You're explaining it well.
All right. So from the streets of Richmond, like a lot of kids growing up, but with some athletic ability, and pulled himself out of it. But unlike a lot of those quote rags to riches stories, this came with mental health issues and legal issues, and it wasn't a smooth path, and probably still isn't a smooth path every day. But he's a serial entrepreneur and author of the book that came out just a couple weeks ago on Amazon. Welcome to the show, George.
Definitely, man. I appreciate it, Scott. I appreciate this opportunity. I checked out a lot of your stuff that you're doing, and I'm glad to be here on your platform.
Yeah, no, I am too, man. I'll tell you right off the bat before we get started, I've been very vocal about issues I've had with depression or mental health issues, mostly in my past, because I thought that made me stronger to make myself vulnerable. But I also admire other men to do that, because it's still, even in 2021, not okay for men to do that. So I commend you for having the balls to put yourself out there.
And I mean, I appreciate that. And I have the same experience. And really, you know, I tell my story in my book, and we can get into that. But yep. the overall piece that I wanted to use was my story and to share the mental health issues that I dealt with, and just using myself, because I know in my community, right, in the hood, it's a stick in it. And I don't even think it got anything to do with being in the hood, just across the table, like you said, as a man, to be that vulnerable to share that you're dealing with these mental issues, the stigma is that you're weak, right? Because that was always my energy, like, come on, just especially in sports, like, come on, pick yourself up, stop being a pussy, like, come on, let's be strong. And so I didn't realize until going through what I went through that I really had an issue, and I really, you know, had to deal with it. And clearly, being from the dynamics where I'm from, the inner city, I know that all my younger nephews and younger friends and the younger guys that I mentor, they dealing with mental health issues, but they doing stuff like popping pills and drinking and abusing weed. And so me being present and letting them know I'm going to therapy, and I even show my therapy sessions on my social medias, it's just trying to show us a different light that, hey, I can say that I'm dealing with these issues, and this is how I'm coping with it. I'm going to get help in this way versus just getting high all day or getting drunk all day or popping perks or popping pills.
Right on, man. I love it. I can't wait to get into it. So I want to start off talking about you grew up in Richmond. I just real quick, this is mostly going to be about you, but when I first heard of Richmond, Virginia, I mean, I'd heard about it historically, right? But the first time I knew about it was in 1991. I moved, I rented an apartment in Richmond, California. I didn't know where that was, but then I read that Richmond was the murder capital of the U.S.
Exactly.
And it turned out it wasn't Richmond, California. It was Richmond. When people say from a rough neighborhood, like, you came from a city that got to be the murder capital of the U.S. for at least 1 year. So tell me what's going up there.
So you're right. A lot of people, depending on, you know, your knowledge, but Richmond was the murder capital of me growing up. I was born in 88. So in 91, we were the murder capital. And so, you know, we ranked that year for murder capital, but that is just the stigma. And it still is. It's crazy. I've, you know, almost all my friends been shot. I got friends that's been killed. And so that's just the norm, right? And so we normalize those type of things where I'm from. And I didn't even know that it wasn't normal until basketball took me around the world or took me to school, or now I move in different places and stuff that I think is normal. Everybody like, that's crazy. But like, that's just where I'm from. And so getting back to my story, you know, I'm the youngest of five brothers. And so basketball kind of kept me out of these things. It was always around me, you know, drugs and murder and everybody having a gun. But basketball is kind of where my safe haven was. And that kind of guided me through these things. And so, you know, all through all these turmoil that was around me and where I grew up, I was able to get out of it per se, right? I was able to use basketball. I went to a prep school my senior year. I got recruited to go to a prep school, the Miller School of Albemarle, which is actually where they shot the movie Major Payne at. I don't know if you've seen that movie, but that's kind of like where, you know, so in the hills, way far from where Richmond was. So I went there. Then I was able to get a scholarship to EMU in Harrisonburg, Virginia. And so basketball was the tool to just bring me out of where I was from. I was able to get my degree. I got my degree in business and in a minor in accounting. And so I went through a lot of traumatic situations which prohibited me from going to play professionally across seas. One of my best friends had a party. He was graduating the same year. I went home, and the night ended up with me being faced with two guys with guns, with five people and five guys and two had guns. And my nature was to fight my way out of it. And luckily, I got out of there with my life. But what happened in the midst of it was I tore the ligament in my thumb. And 2 weeks after that was I was planning to go work out for two teams to go play professionally cross seas. And so I tried my best to ask my doctor to make a cast. Could I work out with a cast on my hand? And I just couldn't get through the pain because I literally couldn't move my thumb. And so I went straight into the entrepreneurship and working in the business world. And where my story kind of picks up at is that I started working for one of my brothers. He used to be my hero. He was 10 years older than me. Well, he's 10 years older than me. He grew up who I wanted to be like. And, you know, it's different when you grow up a kid and when you become a man and now everyone's a man. And so you view people different. And so
can I jump in for a second?
Yeah, definitely.
You're talking about growing up. And I apologize. I'll probably cut you off occasionally because or else ask. So you talk about growing up and growing up as a man in the hood. Parents or parent?
I grew up in my with my mother, but my father was around. So athletics was a big important thing in my family. So my father kind of handled that component of everything. But I lived with my mother. My dad, you know, was in and out. But I always had a relationship with my father.
Okay, so you said basketball pulled you out there, but things like work ethic and commitment and dedication, staying out of legal trouble. I mean, there's other things that were going on that even allowed you to play basketball. Did that come from somewhere?
I always sat back and analyzed everything before me. So, you know, I got to see my brothers in and out of jail. I got to see my friends go in and out of jail. My first scare with the law was, and I'll try to make this short and sweet. The summer prior to going to college, a kid that was at my prep school with me came into Richmond, and I'm gonna just be frank with you. He asked, "Hey man, I'm in town. Do you know where I can get some coke?" And me, being the friend that I was, clearly I didn't sell drugs, but all my friends did. And I ended up connecting them. My friends figured out it was a good idea to just kidnap the kid. This was my roommate in prep school, and their situation went left. The kid got away, and basically my friends and me was on Richmond News at 6 o'clock for armed robbery, kidnapping, and all these type of things. And the only name that the kid knew was me. He went this the whole year with me in prep school. And so I was being charged for kingpin charges for arranging this whole ordeal. And so the court case came down to a week prior to me having to report to college. And my friends got on the stand and said that I didn't know anything about it. So the irony of the whole situation is they went away for 5 years and I went away to college. And so that was like my first time at a pivotal point of my life that my life could have went right where everybody else around me, you know, where their life went, or I went away from school. And I, by the skin of my teeth and my friends being stand up men and just telling the truth, you know, they stood and would say, I didn't know anything about the robbery or anything. And I went away to school.
That's amazing. Cause you always hear the opposite. You always hear about on their friends because that 2 years instead of five.
Exactly.
So now, but since mental health was such an issue, I don't want to like gloss over this. The mental health issues, what were they? And were they starting when you were younger? Is this something that was, tell me about that part early. Thank you.
And so the mental health things that I'm aware of didn't really reach a peak until you know, not none in my youth, but until this where my story kind of pick up and I tell the situation I went through with my brothers. And I think a lot just comes from just the normalizing aspects of what we grew up around. I grew up around people getting murdered and killed. I grew up in Richmond, Virginia, the murder capital. So a lot of things that probably would have traumatized other kids in other cities or whatever the case may be, it didn't traumatize me because that was just our norm. It was norm for everybody to be high or, you know, taking pills, abusing pills and guns and violence. That was just the norm. And so to pick back up with the story, you know, I started working with my brother and me and his relationship kind of ended in like 14, 15. And really, he just was a bad guy. It had reached a peak where he was just lying to my mother. And I just didn't start to like him as a man. He was just a liar and just a bad man. I don't even know how. And so I just parted my ways. Our relationship, you know, we fished for it over Christmas in 2014, 15. And our relationship kind of went our separate way. And I began just my own journey in entrepreneurship. And so my first big business was I started my own mental health company, outpatient services. I saved up $20,000 to start my first company, and it grew. I started one. I started another one back home in Richmond. And then I had an opportunity to expand here to Houston, Texas. And that's kind of like what led me to Houston, Texas. I was able to get a contract with the Houston Independent School District.
Well, so back up. So tell me about
that's a lot. I mean,
like this. What's interesting. So the first one you started, what was it? And like, tell me about this.
So it was in Richmond, Virginia, and I still have it to this day. It's a mental health company. We work with underprivileged kids on Medicaid, and we service that the demographic of the poor inner city kids, and we work with kids with like ADHD, aggression issues, PTSD, and you know we help them.
Is it mostly like pain and mentorship or?
No, it's actually clinical. So I hire clinical staff that actually do assessment and give a diagnosis on these kids, and we provide counseling services with them. So we work on how to deal with their aggression issues, how to deal with their ADHD, and all those different array of diagnoses.
Where does that come from? I mean, where did this desire to not only not follow in the footsteps? Mm-hmm. Because most people follow in the footsteps. This is the trap of, it's not the hood, it's the trap of poverty.
Correct, correct.
Footsteps of those around them. Why not you? And then what makes you want to break the cycle with other people? Like, where does that come from?
I think I always had an entrepreneur mindset. And like I said, basketball always was on the forefront. But like other things that I kind of didn't. In sixth grade, I learned how to sew because growing up, it was a cool thing to have these basketball team patches on your clothes.
Right.
And so I had to take home ec in the sixth grade. I'm sorry, in the seventh grade. And so part of one of the sessions in home ec was how to sew. And clearly all the boys in there are like, man, I don't want to sew. But early at that age, I was like, if I know how to sew, I could do a lot of things and sell it. And so By eighth grade, I was making like $100 a day. Just kids bringing in their T-shirts or their jeans, and I was sewing patches on them, and like literally making like $50 each item of clothes. So I'm always looking for these different ways to just in entrepreneurship. And so as I grew up, it just advanced and advanced. But basketball was always on the forefront. But just behind closed door, I always was just on my toes and just thinking like this. And so the company that I entered into after school and I wasn't able to go play cross seas was a mental health company, but I was just punching holes and stapling, just doing little things just to get a paycheck. But while I was there, it was like, I want to learn this whole thing, how to do the billing, how to do the payroll, how does the services render? What are the credentials of all the different components here at this company? And that was my brother's company. So by the time that me and his relationship had went south, I knew how every component that this could go. And I was like, I could do this on my own. And I saved up my first $20,000 and found a consultant to help me set it up. I didn't know how to set up the company, but I knew how to run it. So I saved up. I found a consultant who was like, hey, I can get you set up, but it costs $20,000. I started my first one. I brought along all of my close friends to work with me, my younger cousin. And I started my first one, and it grew because clearly I was 24 years old in the mental health field, which is awkward because, just to be frank, it's a field just filled with old white people, right? And they're doing things a certain kind of way. But I was able to bring a young, different kind of look to it. And so I look different. The kids interact with me different. And everybody I hired was young and can relate well with this demographic. And that's what separated me from the competitor.
This is cool. All right. So I just love this, but I love, I'm a fan of capitalism. I think capitalism and the idea of making money and being successful mm-hmm. and having stuff like can drive things, but you can channel it different ways. And so you've channeled like becoming personally successful in a way that's also helping people. I mean, is that on purpose?
That is on purpose because, you know, a lot of people, I know a lot of people that get money and make money and they make a lot of money. But when you lay down at night, right, it's just like it's a piece that I get to lay down and be like, yeah, I'm making a lot of money. I'm doing well for myself. But it's a side of the things like I'm doing like good stuff. It make me, you know, it's a piece that you can't take from me. Like I've taken guns out of mother's hands because they wanted to kill themselves. I work with families that deal with the craziest stuff, live with no power. And so it hit different. I'm not just taking money from out of the world. I'm really like doing a change and I'm rerouting kids. I didn't send kids to college and all types of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, fantastic. But this is the where the story starts to get interesting.
It starts to get interesting.
Point in the movie that the story's over.
Right, exactly, right.
This kind of story's beginning.
His story is just beginning.
All right, so this is where the mental health issues start up. So tell me what's going on now.
So in 16, I'm now living here in Houston. My mom's retired. I give my mom $8,000 a month. I'm making $100,000 a month amongst all of my different business endeavors and everything. I'm living the life. I'm living in Houston, Texas, downtown Houston, Texas. And all of a sudden, I started getting phone calls and everybody around me started getting investigated by the federal government. And so it went on for maybe a year before it came directly to me. Basically what happened was my brother company that I worked for those 2 years when I got out of school, he had never paid federal business taxes and he was defrauding the government. He had a scheme going on. He was just stealing. He had been doing this prior to me coming out of college and he was still doing it after I left him. And so the relationship that me and him had went where it went. And like, you know how the federal government work, when they run down on you, if you can throw somebody else in the fire, it helps you out. And so, you know, we didn't know at the time, but my brother had said that he didn't even own his company. He wasn't even operating his company and it was all me. And so the way that federal government, they started attacking me. They started coming to my offices here in Houston. They started investigating all my friends. My mother got subpoenaed, all of these different things. And it was a battle for 2 years. I spent over this whole run of almost $500,000 of just fighting for my life. My brother had admitted to my mother on a recording that he know he lied, but it was to help himself out. This totally severed, you know, family members and my full family. Now my mother was subpoenaed in court. She had to pick a son to be like, you know, vouch for. And the federal government know what they do. They, when they come into a family situation, they just tear, they don't care. I lost all my bank accounts. All of my businesses' bank accounts got shut down. Anybody that was attached to me in any kind of way lost their bank account. I lost 250 points off my credit score. So I had an 800 credit score. I went all the way down to like in the 500s. And for 2 years, I fought. And, you know, it came to a point where they couldn't, everything my brother said was a lie, which, because it was. And the federal government had to go in front of a federal judge and say, you know, we made a mistake. And they basically told my attorney that they was going their separate way. They made a mistake and sorry. And that was that. And I thought it was over. And the part that people don't know is you're not supposed to beat the federal government. That's kind of not supposed to happen. You're never supposed to do that. And I actually did that. And so I moved on. I celebrated. I brought me a new Range Rover, a new Corvette. I had like $30,000 left on my retainer with my lawyer. He had sent me back $30,000. I remember him telling me son. He was an older guy's son. I don't know what you did or who you prayed to, but I never seen the federal government be on someone like that and had to go in front of a judge and say that they made a mistake. So all of the federal agents that were attacking me, they got not debarred, but in their metric system, if you do that and you make that mistake, you kind of you get a strike on your name. Okay. So I moved on my life. I was enjoying life. I was traveling. And like I said, I brought the two cars that I wanted, the Range Rover and the Corvette. And 9 months went by. My same attorney called me and said, "Hey, George, like, are you free?" And I was like, "Yeah." And he was like, the feds have came back and they ready to come get you today. And it rocked my world, because all of the strength that I had those 2 years of fighting, I knew I didn't have the strength in me no more to do that all over again. Because psychologically, like, I can't even describe what it feels like to have those people on your head. They now had came back with a tax case. And so the piece that no one ever knew, but my oldest brother, this brother that I first went through this situation with, was my next to oldest, but my oldest brother was my tax preparer. And so when they came back around with the tax case, I was like, "Oh, well, I know this is straight," because my oldest brother handled my taxes. What they were able to do was go to my oldest brother, found out that he had did over 300 incorrect tax documents, leverage him and say, "Hey, we're going to lock you up for 10 years, or you will work with us to lock up your younger brother." And that's what he did. He became a federal informant. I didn't know. I was flying back home, working with him, trying to get things together, preparing my taxes. And the whole time he was a federal informant. And the charge that I had to take was subscribing to a false tax document. In 2012, I had two jobs that never provided me with a W-2 or a 1099. Clearly, I told my brother, he knew. And the charge that they was able to give me was that I didn't file. He basically said that I withheld information from him, which led him to put my taxes together incorrect, which was a lie. And I had ran out of money. I had ran out of just energy and I had been through so much. The whole journey had been like 4 years, and I had to take a plea. My plea was supposed to be, you know, for 18 months. And I was pushing for a house arrest, but my lawyer told me it was no way I was going to get federal house arrest. And it's a lot of stuff that I'm not supposed to share, but basically the president of my university was a Freemason. And I don't know if you know what a Freemason is, but that's like some high up secret space. But he made a couple of, letters and a phone call, and I was able to get 365 days on federal house arrest here in Houston. And so, you know, when you're fighting for your life, right, for that long, and you stressed at that level, I'm fighting for my life, man. I'm not even realizing all the things that's transpiring. I had two children in the midst of that whole spill, of that whole stint. My youngest son in the midst of all that. I was so detached from just everything because I was literally fighting for my life that I looked up, 4 years was gone, and like my family now is torn apart. I don't have these relationships no more. My relationship with my father kind of is just done because he's real close to my oldest brother. And just the visual, you know, to try to make somebody understand standing in federal court with one, with your brothers, with the federal government, our mutual family behind you. I try in so many ways, and I try with the book and I try to explain it, but I can't even break down like what that feels like. And so luckily I was able to get the federal house arrest, but like now I'm sitting in a house by myself, and just mentally I was just like, I was been fighting for 4 years. And so the mental part started kicking in, because I'm alone now and I'm in Houston. I'm not from Houston, right? I don't have family here to visit me and all those type of things. And sure, I don't even really have family no more either because of what we went through. But the anxiety, the PTSD, the depression that I went through, that's what started me to start write. I didn't set out to write a book. That was how my method is, just writing down stuff that I never shared with people. How I felt about certain things, because I never was this vulnerable. I never was talked about these different things, but I was just writing down. I looked up and I had so much stuff written down that I had reached out to a ghostwriter, and he was like, "Man, we could put this together and it'll be a powerful book." And so I tell that story that I just kind of say, and I put a lot of more details in my book. But at the end of my book, I try to just use my story to shine light on just the stigma of mental health, because I'm around a lot of young guys that go through a lot of crazy stuff. It might be crazier than mine. And I know that they dealing with it, but like where I'm from, you just got to muscle it up and be like, nah, it's just whatever. It's cool, but it ain't really cool. And that's what, you know, you end up doing different things and you tear down your body, you know, and, you know, popping pills like I referenced and getting drunk and, you know, you're not really dealing with stuff like you need to. And so I just was like, look, I'm going to take my story, put it in a book and on social media, just push the stigma of, you know, getting help, you know, when you need help.
So what help did you seek out and what help did you find?
I go to therapy twice a week now. So I found a therapist and we talk on Zoom and we do our sessions twice a week and just help me just decompress all this stuff. Cause I never used to share none of this stuff. It's stuff that, you know, my book, it's people just reading my book that was around me this whole time and never knew certain stuff. It was like, I didn't even know that was going on or you felt like this or like just so much stuff. But going to therapy was allowed me to kind of share these different type of things and just, you know, start trying to make sense of stuff. Like, you know, just try to, how do I trust now, right? Like, cause this happened to these are my brothers. This is who I grew up with. I took showers with them. Like, these are my heroes. How do I trust now? How do I even interact with people and you know, move on and, you know, my family, how do I deal with those demographics? And so the dynamics. So the therapy was helped me day by day, try to deal with these type of things. But like, I still struggle with, being around a lot of people, like when I resurfaced, you know, back out into just the world, because now on top of that, COVID, right? And so it's a lot of just things that I'm dealing with. And then it's just a lot, right? Because like my family never going to be the same ever again. It would never be the same.
I mean, this is why I wanted to talk to you.
Right.
Not your standard story.
No, it's not your standard story. Not at all.
Now, so you're separated from your family. Mm-hmm. You're going to see a therapist. You're not allowed to see a therapist in the hood, right? I mean, that's
like against the code, right? Yeah, exactly.
All right. So are you telling people that you're doing this, or is this like something you're doing in secret? Well, you're doing it on Zoom.
So what I'm doing, I'm going against the norm, right? I know what I'm appealing to, right? I'm tattoos. Like my whole body is tatted up. I listen to a certain demographic, a certain type of music. I know what I'm appealing to. And those are the demographics that I'm trying to reach. And so on my social media, I'm flipping it totally. I actually put my therapy sessions on my social media. So I do live conversations where people come tap in and interact with it. And so like, I actually got the hood now interacting with therapists and understanding these type of things and being like, damn, I am dealing with that. I do have PTSD. I do have anxiety. And I actually have been the middleman of connecting people to get therapy.
So do you have people reaching out to you, making you swear that you won't tell anybody that they're talking to you, and then they like break down and like,
man, my DMs is crazy. And no, they just come out and do it. And people get power of seeing my story because I look like them. I sound like them. Some of these people know me. I get DMs every day. What's the most recent DM? I done had guys hit me they're on the run. They've been on the run for 2 years. I had a girl reach out to me last week. She saw her boyfriend kill himself like a month ago. She didn't know what to do, what she was dealing with. I had a kid in Baltimore at 13. He's been on house arrest for 15 months. He got 7 armed robberies. I have people from Africa reach out to me. So what's going on the back office of my page or what people are saying is like crazy. And it helped me. Just like you said that, you know, you telling your story and hearing other people's story help you out. It's the same thing for me, but it's happening in real time on my social media because of what I'm showing and the vulnerability of what I'm showing on my page.
So is this something that you're going to keep? Well, you're not in house arrest now. You're back.
For 2 months.
Okay. I'm sorry. What?
I've been off for 2 months. I've been free for 2 months.
So are you going to continue this now, like as a business? You're going to basically counsel and do the same thing, just now you have you connect on.
Yeah, it's became part of me now. I see people, I interact with them. People, hey, I wanna chop it up with you, man. I wanna share my story with you. Now people are reaching out to me to pay me to go speak and share my story, just like I did with you, and kind of, you know, shine light on the mental health aspect. So it's became a business and a purpose behind it, other than just a book. Like, I thought it was just gonna be a book and be like, great, that was, I'm an author now, and let that live on Amazon. But now, it, like you say, it's spiraled into a whole different thing, and it's became bigger than me.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can tell talking to you that you could pull off the speaker, because the thing about being a speaker is it's not just information, it's also performance.
Right, exactly.
You have to have a personality behind what you're saying, or else it doesn't matter what you say. I mean, right. It sucks. That's right. The case. That's the way it
is. Yeah, for sure.
That's the thing. Do you switch gears? Like, when you're, like, if you're speaking at, like, I'll just be blunt. If you're speaking at a private college for white kids, do you speak differently? Like at a hood school, like, do you switch your gears, or are you?
Of course, you gotta know your demographic, who you talking to. And I'm in a weird space, right? I'm from Richmond, Virginia, but I went to Eastern Mennonite University, so I already learned that skill early, how to walk on campus around Mennonites, and have to, you know, grow there, learn there, and interact. And so I know how to turn it on. And I'm the owner of all my businesses, so it's certain high up people that I have to go and articulate and handle myself in certain different dynamics. But my natural space is sitting around chilling with my boys, you know, and, you know, in the hood and kicking it. But I'm able to play off both roles, because I am both sides of the fence. I'm able to be in both spaces and be comfortable.
Are you connecting to people? Is it mostly black kids in the hood, or are you connecting to just people everywhere?
It's people everywhere.
Do you find that the kids from your background are connecting easier, or is there just
connecting? It is connecting easier for the demographic of the kids that look more like me, and, you know, from the same demographics of me, because of just what I appeal to, right? And how I talk in my most natural space. So that is the most demographic. It's like a funny thing going on. It's a lot of people that DM me and be like, bro, like, I'm in the hood. I ain't never read a book before. I ain't never got a book before, but it's going to be my first book, which that's dope in itself, right? Like, now right. I got this demographic of people buying books and thinking it's a cool thing. And so, you know, I am realizing that that's who I'm servicing.
So when you're reaching out to kids in the hood, or where they're reaching out to you.
They're reaching out to me, right.
You're recommending therapy and counseling, right? I'm guessing.
For sure, because I can meet them right where I know what they're doing. I know all the young boys popping pills. It's the norm. When all my young boys come out around me, and when I be around, that's the thing to do. Pop Percocets.
How do you cross the, because, well, or I'm not telling you, I'm asking you. Mm-hmm. So when you're talking to the kids in the hood, they're connecting mm-hmm. with you. You look like them. But as is often the case, the social workers are going to be the well-intentioned white lady.
Right, exactly.
But that might be their only options for counselors, especially public service guys. I'm not saying it's the only one, but it often is. Yeah, how do you get kids to make that jump between they're talking to you, they can connect, and you're trying to say, no, that lady, she knows what she's talking about, she just don't look like it.
Exactly. And so
how do you have that conversation?
It is tough. And what I let them know is, you know, your average social worker, licensed professional counselor does look like that, but it's a demographic, and it's growing fast, of people that look like us, that listen to the same kind of music, dress like us, and can talk and meet you where you need to be at. They're going to understand a little bit more than the white guy or the white lady, and they are out there, and I can connect you to them. And so I've been bridging the gap of, like, hey, you know, look at my therapist look just like me. She's a little bit older than me. We sit and talk. We're not using big words that we don't know. We talking right down at the level that they can understand and receive and really digest.
Gotcha. I had an experience with my girlfriend and her two black sons mm-hmm. that live with me out in the suburbs of Colorado. And it was a real unique experience for me, because I've never walked in their shoes. I've never seen the world through their eyes. But when But being with them, I got to not experience it, but kind of.
I got you.
Right. Do you think, you know, do you think that the counselors that aren't from, they're not from the hood, but they work with kids in the hood, do you think they're able to understand what's going on? Or is there always a gap there where they're just, they're never quite going to get it?
And so that's a good question. That demographic that our counselors and have the passion to work with that demographic of people, they know that they will never be able to live like that or understand the day to day what that demographic have to deal with, but they have a passion to just help and try to bring the gap. And so the white counselors, if they don't have a passion to work with the hood, they stay out of it and they don't even try to surf into that. All of the white women that I've met or white men, they really have a passion and they come into and be truthfully honest. Like, look, I would never fully understand because I didn't grow up like that. I grew up here and I look like this. So when I walk out the house, you're dealing with a whole different journey when you walk out your house. So they say that up front, but they got a passion to help and it normally works. But what they deal with is just that initial just forefront. Some of these kids not even going to look your way or even hear you out because it just, you're white. And so that's one of the, that's half of the battle. But normally if you can get past that first little initial, I see it happen all the time. The white counselors and black people work well. But what I've been showing on my page is that the lady I work with is a middle-aged black woman. She's cool. She's like your home girl. She's a straight shooter. And, you know, it's a comfortable space for me. And that's what works for me.
You know that we're not even supposed to have this conversation in 2021. Like,
why you say that?
Like, you're not even supposed to like use the terms white and black anymore because we're all.
Exactly.
It's the biggest load of crap because it's not accurate and it's not fair to not accept there's differences, right?
Yeah, right. It is. And that's kind of like where you get lost at. They say you're not supposed to talk like that, but that's to cover it up because it's still there. Covering it up, not going to, you know, do anything. But the truth of the matter, man, is drastically different, man. Like, it's drastically, you know, when I was going through my court case with the federal government, you know, my lawyer was pulling up situations like mine, right? Clearly with, like, black kids or black people. I mean, with white people and everything. He was like, yo, this is crazy. Like, look at all this stuff. I have, like, a nonprofit. You know, I was able to get a USDA grant for like 4 years. I fed all the projects in my city when I first got out of school. These are different things that I just did. I didn't know, I didn't do it because I was in federal trouble or anything. This is just my track record of all this type of stuff. I had an outpour of just all these kids that are in jail that I work with, I mentor, I speak to every day. They wrote letters to the judge from in jail. Like, and so when my lawyer looking at all the stuff that I did, he was like, there's no way they should be handling you like this. Cause just what you are to your society, to where you from, and not just centralized in Richmond, just across the table. And so, you know, it is what it is, man. Like, I'm black, it is what it is. I'm normalized to it. So I don't walk around like, I'm black, you're white. I know my journey is different. I don't hold it against anybody. I don't think it's nobody's fault. It's just, that's what it is. It is what it is.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I just, you know, I deal with my mental health and, you know, I just know that when I walk out this door, I gotta move a little bit different than, you know, other people.
Yeah, fair. Yeah. So without the connection to your family, who's your family now? Or is this something?
Out of my whole family, I am close with my younger cousin. She owns one of my companies along with me. Me and my mother, our relationship is still there. We went through a tough patch because in the midst of what was going on, when we didn't know my brother was an informant, she was telling him a lot of stuff just as a concerned mother of what was going on. So she shared a lot of stuff that ended up hurting me, like my whereabouts, where I lived at, where my office was, just a lot of stuff. And so we kind of hit a wall, but my mom actually almost got locked up for attempted court because she went to court when my brother went to court. And so imagine, you know, my brother's attorney saying all these type of stuff, and my mother's in the background like, that's a lie, Your Honor, that's a lie. And the federal judge stopping and saying, who is this lady? My mother said, that's my son, and he's lying on my other son. And so my mother almost got locked up. Like the sheriff had to pull her out and say, like, if you interrupt again, we're gonna have to lock you up. And so these type of things was happening in real life. I got the transcript. I wasn't there. Clearly, I couldn't be there. But I read the transcript. Was like, wow, that's great.
So the family members that you're now not connected to, right, is there a path for them back in with you, or is this something that are the bridges burned?
It's tough, man, because you know part of what therapy is, and we just get into that, is like forgiveness, right? And it's twofold. For me to fully move on and get this stuff off me, I gotta forgive, right? And so that's like for me. That's just, they don't got nothing to do with them, just for me. Then the other side is that I gotta accept, you know, if they're apologetic or whatever the case may be, and can I move on from that? And the thing is, it's too early, man. Like, I tell them my story in the book. I flew to DC. No one even knew, because I knew the how technology worked, how it could go if something went left. But I flew to DC, where one of my brother lives, in the midst of all this, when I was just down and out, and I slept outside his house for 3 days with my gun, and I didn't know what was gonna happen. But I ain't have no other option. I couldn't process nothing else to do in my natural state and where I'm from. You got to take means into your own hands. And, like, that's where I was just at mentally. I had went so far financially in business and took it so far that at my most natural space, like, when all else fails, I resorted right back to, like, where I'm from and, like, how we handle things. And so that situation is a situation I highlight in my book, where just mentally I didn't have no options. I didn't have nobody to talk to. And how I processed it was just like, nah, I got to go see him. And, like, I got my guns out here. I'm going to fly into Richmond. I got a rental car, drove to D.C., sat outside his house for 3 days. He ain't come home. And now, looking back, I'm glad he didn't, because I don't know what would have happened, because at that point. But that was just the mental space that I was in. But to answer your question, have I forgiven for my sake so I can move on?
Out of you forgiven, is there a path for that person to ever come back into your life? Like, or have you ruled this person out? Like, okay, you're no longer part of my.
I never want those relationships ever again. I don't need them. I don't feel like I need them. But do I know that at some point in my life I'm gonna have to forgive and accept what happened? Yes. But as in, would things ever be the same ever again? Nah, because never. And because it just get deep. And a piece. How we started developing this book with my ghostwriter, we had to, you know, what's going to be our overall theme? And so my book is based off the biblical story of Cain and Abel. I actually got a picture of the whole biblical. This is a whole picture depicting the story of Cain and Abel. And I don't know if you know that story, but that's where the older brother killed the younger brother out of jealousy and whatever dynamics. But that's what we pull from my story. And that's kind of like my situation where, you know, my two oldest brothers, you know, they didn't literally try to kill me with a weapon, but, you know, it felt like they was killing me. And so, is it a path right now? No. I know I don't ever want those relationships, but I know at some point I have to forgive and accept what happened and move on and don't carry any, you know, ill will towards it.
Okay. You have kids.
Mm-hmm. Three.
Three. What's your path with them? Like, what are you going to do that's going to make things different for them?
It's tough, man, because we spoke about this. I speak about this in therapy. Like, family isn't a thing for me, right? Like, it's not something that I really have value for or I see value for at this point, just because my personal journey. And so it gets tough with kids, right? Because I don't want to put that on them, right? I don't want to become an advocate like, nah, you don't really, you know, you just really need me and your mom and everything. And so my trauma comes up in the relationships of these other blended families that I'm part of, because it's not important to me, right? Like, I don't really be caring for the people outside of just my son or my daughter and their mother. And they have families and they enjoy their families, but like, I don't need, it's not part of my ecosystem, right? Like, but families in other people's lives, that's part of their daily, they talk to this person, they talk to their mothers, their fathers, their sisters, and that's not my case. And so it's something I gotta figure out, because, like, you know, I don't want to put that on them, but it's something that I just know I gotta figure out and help them with that, even though that I don't even have no value for it.
I gotcha. Yeah, I'll tell you one. I'll share something real quick about me. Mm-hmm. So when I wrote my autobiography, you know, the book opened up with, you know, I get to give one sentence, one quote that's going to be the theme of the book that I want everybody. You know, you get to pick this one sentence that's going to encompass everything you want to say.
Right.
One message you want people to take. And what I wrote was, it's my favorite expression in the world. It's go where the love is, not where it's supposed to be.
That's good. I should have stole that.
Right. But the whole theme of it is basically there's love there, but then it's not always in with the people that you think it's supposed to be. And as long as you go to the right direction, that's a win. And my life has been centered around, I have some shit family. Mm-hmm. But I don't need them. I have this whole other family that is what I need.
Right. Yeah. I receive that.
All right. So what does someone do? Like, how do they reach out to you? How do they find you? What does someone do when they're struggling?
Got you, man. You know, right now I'm sending all this energy and traction through my Instagram. My Instagram is @2x, the number 2x crossed. You know, represent the double cross, but it's 2x cross. And, you know, I interact a lot. I do a lot of stuff. Like I said, I integrate a lot of different things. Like, I'm part of an affiliate marketing program. So I've sent probably 15 people to Miami on free trips, because I could give out free trips. So, like, people that are struggling and they tell me their personal story, I let them know, like, hey, man, like, if you can find a break, I'll send you to Miami for a weekend and for free, totally free. So I try to do different interacting type of things. I try to share my story. Hopefully that helps out another person. Clearly, I want them to buy my book, because I would appreciate them buying my book, but I have the merch as well. But, you know, coming to my Instagram page, you'll see a whole bunch of different things. I have reenactments of certain things that transpire. I have actually voiceovers, because stuff was being recorded during this. I actually have them, and I put this stuff up on my social media. Like, I literally have my brothers telling my mother, Mom, I know I lied, but I don't have a relationship with him no more. Like, crazy stuff that people be like, is that real? And it's really real. I put my paperwork on my social media. Like, you can see my brother saying this in court, like the whole thing. It's like a movie.
Gotcha. Well, I'll definitely put all the links up on the page.
Definitely. I appreciate that.
Man, I do appreciate your time. I love people that are taking the shit and giving it back in a way that's not shit.
Right. I got you. Yeah.
I couldn't think of a better way to phrase that.
That's perfect. Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah, definitely. But, man, I appreciate you. I've done probably 50 podcasts or interviews. This is the dopest one. Like, I like you for sure.
I appreciate that. Well, I'll keep following you. And cool. Well, hey, thanks, everybody. I'll put the links up. Maybe we'll follow up with you in a while and see how things are going.
I appreciate that.
Hey, everyone, thanks for tuning in. I hope you guys enjoyed this. Go out and buy the book. Go out and buy Double Crossed. If this isn't a story, if you don't buy the book, definitely go see the movie in 4 years.
right, definitely.
You know, so, but hey, thanks again. Thanks again, George. Appreciate it.
Gavin, appreciate it, man.
Hey, everyone. I'm now on Patreon. Click the link below. Not only keep the free content coming with tutorials, tips, podcasts, etc., but get a bunch of free stuff like live stream Q&As, copying my book, voting on topics, behind the scenes, bunch of cool stuff. Click the link down below to join.